You're watching The Sports Objective, the podcast for Pirates. You're listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join Coach C, a USA Strength and Conditioning Hall of Famer, every Monday night to see in a variety of guests, including former players, former and current coaches, pastors, and others will discuss relevant issues in coaching today's athlete, with the goal of equipping the athlete and those coaching them with the physical, mental, and spiritual armor necessary to live their best life. Here's Coach Connors.
Welcome to Absolute Empowerment. Tonight we've got another very special night because we have longtime, highly successful Division I coach and former ECU defensive coordinator coaching a defense that contributed greatly to two conference championship titles, Coach Greg Hudson. Coach, great to have you in the house.
Jeff, it is awesome to be with you. And every time I get introduced as we get older, it just seems to get better. So my playing career and my coaching career always improves every time I do an interview. So thank you for that.
Yes, sir. What I'm going to do is recognize my sponsor here and then we'll roll.
All right.
We got Ed Watkins Marine. Ed Watkins Marine has two locations to serve you as they are located in Denver and Cornelius, North Carolina, in the greater Charlotte area of our state. He has fishing boats, pleasure boats, pontoon boats, center consoles, family-friendly bow riders, trailers, engines, and UTVs. He has all the brands you are seeking, Sea Pro, Suncatcher, pontoons, Tritunes, Stingray, Yamaha, Suzuki, Mercury, Vexus Bass Boats, Explore Skiffs, and more. Whether you're looking for a new boat or to repower your existing boat, Ed Watkins can help you with your boating needs. Visit them online at edwatkinsmarine.com. We appreciate Big Ed's support of the show. And Big Ed was a very enthusiastic and positive player on the East Carolina football team. Thank you, Big Ed.
Thank you, Big Ed.
Yes, sir. So, Coach, I was wondering first if you could kind of briefly give me an overview of your collegiate coaching career. Then we'll come back and revisit that, I'm sure. But
okay.
It's been quite a career.
I will give you the Reader's Digest version, and I'll start off that many people don't know that I actually was a college baseball coach first, and I was a GA, a grad assistant at Notre Dame for Pat Murphy, who's now the manager of the Brewers. Teammate was Craig Council, the manager of the Cubs. And then Murph knew I wanted to get into football, and that was the direction I actually wanted to go, and because I'd played baseball and football at Notre Dame. And he got me my first job, and I went to Southern California, and I worked at the University of Redlands, which is out past San Bernardino on its way to Palm Springs. Started graduate school, and I actually did get my master's degree there. I finished it up mostly at Notre Dame and another stop, but I got it. And I coached football and baseball there, Division III level. We won some championships back-to-back, and both baseball and football. And then Coach Holtz hired me back in 93. To be a GA, and he moved me to offense because he knew I wanted to be a defensive coordinator, and Woody Hayes had moved him to defense to help him be a better offensive coach when he hired him back at Ohio State. So I coached offensive line for the legend Joe Moore, a la the Joe Moore Award, and then I was Skip Holtz's offensive line coach at UConn for 3 years, and then Rick Minner, who had been a D coordinator at Notre Dame when I was there as a GA, he hired me at Cincinnati, and I was there 4 years and got my first glimpse of the newly finished upper deck here at Pirate Stadium at the FIC. And that's when a family friend of mine, who's your D coordinator, Tim Rose, left Cincinnati and went to Minnesota with Glenn Mason for 4 years. And while I was at Cincinnati, I moved back to defense after 2 years. And then Mace gave me my shot after the first season as a young guy to be a defensive coordinator in the Big Ten. And I had to grow up real fast and stayed there for 4 seasons. And Skip got the job. And I said, why not? knew we weren't going to beat Michigan and win the Big Ten, but I knew we could win a championship here. That was the main reason, was we could win a championship. And we did. Was here for, was I here, five? And then I left and went to Florida State for three, and then went to Purdue for three, and then went to Notre Dame for one. And then after we worked every single day in June, and this is changing, and took a break. And I did go down and live in Florida. My wife and I moved down once we were empty nesters and helped my mom out with my dad. And I coached high school football for one season. Had a blast, absolute blast. And that's it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I had an opportunity to coach with Tim Rose here.
Yeah.
He was a very unique individual. I know when he was between jobs, he actually worked at Disney World.
Which yeah, he I did.
Was very interesting, and he really enjoyed that. And, you know, Tim, of course, it was also very interesting to me because I don't think he wore headphones.
Did not.
And, you know, sometimes he would drop about 10 guys into coverage.
Yes, he would.
So, yeah, unique. I really liked him, Tim Rose. I was also a very big fan of Bruce Springsteen, as he was.
So
In
am
fact,
I.
In fact, we attended a Bruce Springsteen concert together, and Tim Rose knew every word to every song.
I think I do, too.
So,
actually, my youngest son, Jack, has a tattoo on his arm. It says, "No retreat, no surrender." So nice. I looked at that as good parenting with the music he listened to when he was in the car seat.
Well, when he was here, I put up the words the Blood Brothers.
That's right.
Excuse me, for our team to listen to.
That's awesome.
Also, I wanted to ask you this. Was Mickey Marotti there also?
Yes. I worked. That's where I first met Get Thick with Mick.
Yep.
And this was before the cell phones really got hot, and my phone rang in my desk phone rang in my office. And it was Mickey at UC after the 97 season. And all he said to me was stealth. And I said, and that was his code word for come see me on a stealth mission. That's all he would say, stealth. And he'd hang up. I went down, and he had an interview at Cincinnati with Bob Baby. And he asked if I knew him. Man, I proceeded to call everybody I knew, from, you know, the AD to the trainers, the doctors. And lo and behold, he ends up at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And ever since then, if he calls me, he doesn't say, "How you doing?" He'll actually say stealth, and he'll hang up.
I have to remember that. I had him on a podcast recently.
Okay.
I think you'll enjoy that. And Mickey's a good friend, and, you know, he's had some great accomplishment in strength and conditioning, and, you know, still at Ohio State making close to $1 million a year.
That's right.
I applaud Mickey Marotti.
That's right.
Coach, if you would, can you tell me a little bit about how you developed an affinity for the defensive side of the ball? What's the history there?
Well, first and foremost, defense is where a lot of glorified young quarterbacks end up. And I started playing linebacker in my freshman year of high school. And fell in love with it. I just loved everything about it. It was a great year to be a high school player and watch guys like Lawrence Taylor and Chip Banks. And I knew probably from fifth grade on that I wanted to coach. Maybe it was the influence of my little league coaches. So linebacker was a natural fit for me and matched my mentality. Playing middle linebacker is a pretty cerebral position. I really played for some great high school coaches. We won the USA Today National Championship while I was at Moeller in Cincinnati. We were really good. We were well coached, and they had a great influence on me. And we were really as good as we were on offense. We were spectacular on defense. I mean, we were really good, and we were well coached, and we were also ahead of the game a little bit. We were a high school that in the late 70s and in the early 80s was heavyweight training, and that was a big difference for us. And we had talent. And from there, I got lucky to go to Notre Dame, and I just had a run of coaches I was around, from Rick Lance, who ended up D coordinator at many places. Virginia was one where he's there quite a bit. And then I got Foge Fazio, who at one time was the head coach at Pitt, and he had Ricky Jackson and Hugh Green, and they were a fan, you know, when Marino was there. And I got to be around Foge, and he really made an impression on me. And I still would catch myself repeating some things that Foge used to say about being cool out on the field and calm. And he had some slickness to him, and he was smooth and he's smart. And then Coach Holtz hired Barry Alvarez, and it was over from there. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be around Coach Alvarez. He's my mentor in football. I've never made a decision in football without calling him. And I told Coach Holtz when he met with me before he hired me as the graduate assistant job down at the coaches convention, he said, "What's your goal? What do you want to get out of this? What do you want to be?" And I said, "I want to be the next Barry Alvarez. I want to be the defensive coordinator at Notre Dame." And that's when he said, "Well, good, I'm going to move you to offense with Joe Moore, and that'll help you." And I thought it was going to be baseball for a minute, and then I just had to get back to football. I knew that was the direction. And I went out and started coaching linebackers, Division III school in Southern California. And then Lou hired me back, and I moved offense for a brief period. And that really helped me even have a greater affection for defense. I felt like I had some insider trading information, and it's just a lot of fun to me. I enjoy the scheme. I enjoy the creativity. I enjoy putting the players in the right place to succeed. And I love the aggressive part and the aggressive nature of it. So it was just a natural fit for me. And I just ran with it.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm from Pennsylvania, of course, so I'm very familiar with Foge Fazio. My father was a high school coach there for many years. And
Barry was from Western PA, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that Barry Alvarez is in a dozen halls of fame.
Probably.
I happen to be in one with him in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Sports Hall of Fame. And that's just a great honor for me to be in there with somebody like Barry Alvarez.
Yeah, he's been great to this day. I mean, he's been great. Even when my son was playing at Purdue, he came on the field in pregame, and I was standing there with my son when I was able to coach him. And he walked up, walked right past me, and started pointing in my son's chest and said, "You're better than your dad." And he said, "See you later, hud."
Well, Coach, I was a strong corner in college in a 52 slant and angle base scheme.
Yeah.
And we were always very gap sound and always pressured the quarterback, which of course helped me as a strong corner. Of course, I always went to strong formation, and I was
right.
I lined up about 6 or 7 yards deep, so I never got beat deep. But I really enjoyed that 52 slant and angle back then. Can you kind of describe the evolution of defensive schemes the last few decades a little bit?
Yes. For me personally, when the computer age had started manifesting in college football, and the ability to watch, a lot of film faster and study. And then while I was a GA at Notre Dame, we had Beta, which, was from the the TV industry. So we had great tape, you know, the rewind and all that stuff was flawless. So I got to watch a lot of tape and study a lot of film. And one of the biggest jobs I had as the offensive GA was to break film down for Coach Holtz. And we always opened up with Michigan. So, and he would only want me to break down games from the previous years, Notre Dame versus Michigan. And he always thought Michigan played us different than they played the rest of the season. Well, they were a, you know, 52, the Michigan slant and angle defense. I mean, that was Bo, and that was Michigan for years. Yeah. And so I grew closer to that by watching it so much. And I sort of took a liking to it. And I also, because I was an offensive line coach, I knew that the number one thing that bothered offensive linemen was movement. And if you look at the film from our defense, in particular from the 2006, from the bowl game again in Hawaii against Boise, all the way through to the end, we became basically a 5-2 slant and angle team, but it looked like we were in a 4-2-5. But I was running the slant and angle defense, and we moved 80% of the time in those last two, starting with the Hawaii Bowl, then the next two. We moved 80% of the time. Our front was always active. And it looked like a 5-2 because I started giving a thumbs up. That was the signal. It's the only thing I changed out of the 4-3 is I gave Zach Slade a thumbs up, and he would stand up. And I would give him little hand signals of where to line up and move around. But we were still playing 4-3 quarters, but it looked like a 5-2 slant and angle defense. So with gap integrity, I mean, we had a foxhole mentality, and we were not going to differentiate from it one bit. We weren't going to two-gap anything. We're going to be a attacking, penetrating defense. So, you know, that's where I sort of morphed into. And but then we also, I was lucky enough to be at Cincinnati when Rich Rodriguez was the offensive coordinator, if you remember this, for Bowden.
Yeah.
For Tommy Bowden. And that's when they had that 13-0 run. And Rick Smith was the D coordinator there. And we were seeing the early stages of the gun read. And just being exposed to that from that first season on, I really got a head start on gun read defense, on little things to do as far as the reads and the swiping and the, you know, replacing of the linebackers for the defensive end, you know, basically turning your defense into a option defense all the time. And so it morphed from where how you were playing your defensive ends to I wanted to stand them up, and the guys on the staff thought I was crazy in a 4-3 because we were getting ready for West Virginia every year. And I said, why don't we just stand our defensive ends up, because as soon as the ball snapped, their hand comes off the ground, they're in a two-point stance. Well, now everybody's doing it.
Yeah,
and that's been one of the bigger things is the ends in a stand-up with, you know, just two guys down, sometimes one. And the changing of the offense, you know, the RPOs. And I think defenses have caught up a little bit in the last few years. They were getting gutted for a while. But it still comes down to those guys up front. I mean, you can do all you want on the back end. And you looked at our defenses. We were a great defense the last 2 years for our level in our conference and maybe a little bit nationally. But we had draft picks on the front, and we had great college football players at linebacker and DB. But we had pros up front, and that was the difference.
Gotcha. I guess I'd want to ask you, if you get hired tomorrow as a DC, what's that base defense look like? How do you recruit specifically to, I guess you could say, the horsepower that makes that builds that high performance engine?
Yeah. You know, I would still probably I would have that same philosophy here that I had with the 4-2-5 and standing a guy up. I would look for a lot of Zach Slates. You know, the 6'4 long arm guys that can take up a lot of space and can run. You know, everybody's got to be able to run and be in condition. You know, big men running and little men hitting. You know, the big, little guy, you know, the DB's got to be physical. They got to tackle. That free safety, that bonus linebacker is going to have 100 tackles. And that's not because guys are making mistakes. That's because he's in the fit. And, you know, I would still go after two as big as humanly possible that can take up space in the middle, and then just try to out-athlete you with tough guys that love football. You know, that would be a criteria. I want guys that like really being miserable at times practicing football. And without that DNA, you know, it's tough to be great on defense.
No doubt. And I'll just throw this in, you know, as a former defensive back, I mean, you know, you're even back in the day when there, you know, there wasn't now, you know, high tempo offense, you had time to get lined up, but
right,
you go run with a post, you might run with an out and up. Now you got to force on a sweep, and now you got to run with something else. And I mean, you know, I really believe that defensive backs got to be in better shape than anybody else, because it's not like receivers where you're going to sub a bunch of guys. You know, you're only going to have so many lockdown corners right now.
Yeah, you got to run all day.
You got to run all day, man.
Conditioning supersedes everything.
Yeah.
And we started practice off, as you know, we started practice off every day on defense. We ran.
Yeah.
You know, we were going to practice with our blood bubbling. And if you're not in condition, the fatigue is going to make you a coward. Mistakes are going to happen, and everybody's going to be miserable. And it's controllable. You know, you can get in. Everybody can get in condition. It doesn't have to do with that doesn't have to do with talent. And I would also say that in the defense, you know, if it didn't have to do with talent, we had to be the best in the country. We could be national champs at things that didn't have to do with talent.
Well, I always love pursuit drill as a conditioner also on defense.
keep running.
That'll make a man out of you.
Just run.
Well, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your journey as a player, kind of growing up, and more specifically, who were the folks that instilled character and leadership, you know, as instrumental tools in your personal arsenal? Can you give us a little background there about growing up and who were the people that really influenced you?
You know, it was right away from grade school at St. John's in Deer Park, outside of Cincinnati. You know, the Catholic school leagues back in Cincinnati where I grew up, you know, everybody played sports, you know, everybody was involved. And from third grade on, it was, you know, full go. It was football, baseball, and basketball. And the CYO youth leagues, youth organizations that we had in Cincinnati were, you know, very competitive. You played all your grade schools, you got to know other kids. But the one thing I noticed is I had these guys that were coaches, and they showed up every single day. You know, they were there every season. They were there every day, and they were always so positive. And the influence I had on, you know, I had Pat Flaherty at St. John's and Ty Steele. I mean, I can just name these guys, Mr. Conroy in baseball and playing for the Deer Park Cobras and, you know, and Deer Park, you know, those guys had a great influence on me. And then I was lucky enough to go to at the time, a national power in high school football. And we had great coaches, and they worked. If you came in, you know, they got a lot of traffic from college coaches coming in to recruit. Well, if you walked in, you were going to spend an hour or two at Moeller, because the coaches were going to drill you and get information from you. They were going to learn from you. You were going to get on the board, and you were going to teach them something before you left. And between our strength and conditioning and then the way we were coached in such a positive way, I mean, they would get on us, but there was also a mix of responsibility, your character, the way you acted off the field, the way you carried yourself, the way you played, your sportsmanship. You know, everything that we say is lacking today was tremendously emphasized with me in every sport I played by every single coach I had from the third grade all the way through my senior year of high school. And those guys set the foundation for some of the things that I ended up, you know, believing in wholeheartedly. And it really came down to how you treat people and how you, you know, how did those men treat me in grade school? They treated me like they would treat their own son. And that had an impact on me. And, you know, your youth coaches in your neighborhoods, you know, they were local heroes. You know, some of them had gone on and played sports and stuff like that. And you looked up to them. And the affection that I felt that I had towards my youth league and high school coaches was one that I always wanted to get from my players. I wanted them to play well because they knew it was good for all of us. It would make me happy. I didn't want to let my coaches down.
Yeah.
You know, and that almost took a pressure. You know, you wanted to win, but man, I did not want to see my coach disappointed. And whether that was wanting approval or getting approval or whatever it was, that was a mindset that I had. And I always wanted to make sure that I was hoping those guys had that feeling to do their best for certain reasons.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about or have you mentioned something about the influence of Lou Holtz on you. But I will mention, because of the greatness of Lou Holtz, one of my I guess you could say one of my moments in time was walking across the field with Steve Logan to shake Lou's hand after we beat South Carolina that year. And, you know, that was special to me because, of course, all the great accomplishments of Lou Holtz and who he was. But I've always had a tremendous amount of respect for him. And can you just give me a little bit there?
Yeah, of course. You know, again, I was fortunate to have the opportunity to go to Notre Dame and for Lou Holtz to be the coach. And, you know, it was almost the relationship that you had with your father, to where when you were young and growing up and a teenager, he was the dumbest person in the room. And then when you got older and experienced and had more responsibilities, you were amazed at how much smarter your father got. And I had that same relationship. You know, as a player, at times you're frustrated. You're like, this guy wants to kill us. He wore us out. He grinded us. Man, there was nobody better at motivating a team of young, influential, tank neck lunkheads that wanted to win bad. And he just had the ability to completely control the team, control the room, but he also had the magic that you felt like he was coaching you individually all the time. You felt like in every single meeting he was talking to you. And there's a difference, that there was no daydreaming and there was no sleeping in those meetings or in those one-on-ones with him. Then his influence on me got much greater because I got to work for him and I got to see the other side. And I realized then that Lou Holtz cared so much about the players in Notre Dame, and there was a perception that he didn't. And I've defended that because I have sat one-on-one with him in his office, closed door, for lengths of time, and just had talks about things in the past at Notre Dame. And, you know, the book was coming out when he was there, Under the Tarnished Dome. And he was so concerned that he might have done something that was not favorable to the lady on the dome. I mean, he was genuinely miserable about that. And he just had a way of finding that button in you, whether it's with one word or one line or one speech. He just had that power. Very few people have it, and he does. And he has great discipline in believing in his plan for success. And he sets it. He does not deviate from it. And he's committed to it almost to a fault. And that's the reason he's successful, is because he has a plan. He believes it's infallible and he executes it. And he believes if you stick to the plan, you shouldn't win a game. And he's right. And he really, he brought the word love in football to me to a higher level.
Yeah.
You know, you find out, this is a word that's misconstrued, but you, when you find out how intimate you can get within a team, the strength that you gain from that is another level. And that's hard to get. You know, we became an intimate defense as we grew together and had a feeling of, I mean, we were not going to let each other down. And Lou, Coach Holtz, built that into me, and I was able to pass it on. And then I was lucky that the consummate understudy of Lou Holtz, who's Skip, who was same philosophies and with a completely different personality that was so positive. You know,
yeah, bro.
I'm almost, I'm right with you there, man. And
yeah, I mean,
you know, there was no way. I mean, there were some games we're getting ready to play that I was on Tuesday going, damn, this is going to be a mother. I mean, I'm looking at spreads wondering what Vegas thinks about the ass whooping we could get. And Skip's bouncing around the hallways, clapping, being positive. Let's have a great day. And, but his dad put that in us, man, about belief. There, you know, we were love, trust, commitment, belief, and don't flinch. And that was everywhere. And he always reminded us that we didn't have to be the greatest team in the country. We just had to be the best in the stadium that day.
Well, you know, I did a podcast with Kevin Colbert, vice president and GM of the Steelers for many years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you get a chance, you can listen to that. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, he started kind of an organization for former Steelers, lend a hand. And the thing that he talked about is, you know, when we get out of this stuff, we get kind of lost. You know, sometimes we get lost because of what you just talked about. And that's that intimate component within a team that you can't replicate.
Yeah.
And so that's, of course, you know, I retired. I mean, I had a couple even last week, my former GA calls me and says, hey, if you come take this Cornell job, we'll hire you. So I'm like, no, I can't do that. but the thing about it is that when you have an opportunity, even after you retired, and you think about just that component,
right,
that team intimacy that's an emptiness within your right soul that you have to fill somehow.
Yeah.
That's the one thing, in my opinion, that you miss. And that's why Kevin Cole did that, where, hey, these guys are out of the league maybe 5-6 years, all of a sudden they're lost. Some of them even
right
are financially in trouble.
Yeah, you mentioned a good point right there when you talked about the loss of identity.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, in our arena, that loss of identity has a date tied to it where you can almost predict when it's going to happen, when you know it's the last game of your senior year.
Yeah.
You know, the pros is a different level, but you know that it's ending and right, you prepare for it a little bit, but when it ends, man, it shuts off. I mean, it's a light switch.
Yeah.
And you know, when you go from glamour, glitz, championships, national TV, just a guy, you know, it affects you.
Well, and the other thing too is, of course, I've mentioned it to you that this is a Christian podcast and so forth. We get into some different topics here, and we talk about spiritual strength. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about is that spiritual warfare you got to fight every day,
right,
with temptations and so forth. And you better be ready for that. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that we have to, I know that's really helped me to fill a void, that void that we were talking about. And it's been empowering to me. And that's basically why I call this podcast Absolute Empowerment, because it's been absolutely empowering to me. And so, sure. You know, I really like to share that too. And I was just wondering, can you give me your three, big moments in time as a player or a coach, just the top three that you remember?
Oh, top three as a player. I went when the second clicked off in high school when we beat Maslin for the state championship, the national championship, USA Today. That was a big one. First time I ran out of the tunnel at Notre Dame, that was different. That really gripped me. And when I got named when it was said Greg Hudson, defensive coordinator at Notre Dame, when I had reached that goal that I had set with Coach Holtz back in 1992, you know, that was pretty big.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, being Irish and coming from Western Pennsylvania, a little piece of heaven would have been for me to play for Notre Dame, believe me. So,
yeah, I'm
very envious there, and you certainly were blessed. So,
yeah, very much so. I mean,
yeah, no doubt,
very blessed.
So, I want to, you know, obviously, we spent some time in two different. Actually, I was there twice, but. Some different eras of success in East Carolina. You know, we don't talk enough about your era.
Right.
Of course, I talk a lot about the Steve Logan era and Bill Lewis because I was there then. And with Ruffin, we won 10 games during that time too, of course, which, you know, everybody's certainly proud of. But, you know, your perspective of what was accomplished at ECU, you know, during the Holtz era, the culture. I always say, you know, people come in and say they want to establish the culture. What I say at ECU, you recapture the culture because the culture is so deep.
Yeah.
You know, ECU started football in 1932 or whenever. But, you know, the reasons for success, maybe what Skip Holtz would have needed not to go to South Florida.
Right.
What your future vision was for ECU during that time period.
Yeah.
A little perspective there based on what that was and what's going on now, possibly. And, you know, I talk about those things without trying to be critical of anything. You know, I just had a vision for ECU that was maybe a little different than it is now. Than what's transpired, of course, the NIL and all this stuff that's part of that deal. But all those things that kind of I was mentioning, give me some perspective there.
You know, along the same lines that I sort of hit some places at the right time and was lucky, you know, from high school to ending up at Notre Dame. And now I meet Skip and I mean, Skip and Jen are the godparents of my oldest child and Garrett. And, it starts at the top, and Chancellor Ballard was very supportive. And from there, we had Terry Holland, who was amazing, and then Jimmy Bass with him.
Yeah.
And if you notice about our staff is we didn't have a lot of turnover, and we had a really good thing. And we loved working together. We liked living here in Greenville. I really think Terry thought outside the box and was able to do some things for us financially. And some of the perks that we had were not necessarily an overall initial salary, but some other ways for revenue, almost like a profit sharing and season tickets and we got a nice camp check because we had the Beast of the East cranked up, and that was nice. And we also had an opportunity. You know, Terry had some foresight that he saw what we did, you know, that first year. And he wanted to keep us together. So we had a wrinkle in our contract for if we stayed, you know, for some longevity. And if you want somebody to stay, I mean – in a job, I don't care whether it's football or field hockey or teaching, you know, you got to pay them. And we were in good position for that. And we were on the right track. I think, you know, me personally, I think really if the administration and the board would have said, we're not going to lose these guys, no matter what it cost, which is done now. I think we might've stayed. I think the band would have stayed together. I really do. And I think that just has to do with vision. I mean, you look at where you're at right now and you look at the schedule, who you're playing, you know, what has happened? We were playing great teams. We were playing a tough non-conference schedule. We were filling the stadium. And what I always didn't understand a little bit, and I'm not sour graping it, but you know, I always wondered why you had to get a job offer to get, you know, an increase.
Yeah.
I always wondered, you know, I did ask it one time when I did get a job offer and I got offered a higher salary. I said, well, where was this money yesterday?
Yeah.
You know? And I think had the vision been that we want to not worry about what other people think, because Central Florida was paying more than we were. And they were, you know, they were the team to beat, and we were beating them.
Yeah.
And Skip was one of the highest paid coaches in Conference USA and in some of the other leagues,
yeah.
But the staff wasn't. And that's not Skip's fault. You know, that's the other people. And yeah. Sometimes you battle perceptions and, well, we're not going to pay this much for somebody to coach football. It's not about that. It's about keeping that program cranking it out and that stadium full and, you know, and being on television as much as you can. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, you look at it now, you know, it's a revenue business and there's a price for doing business. And I saw that even Glenn Mason battled that at Minnesota and it took a while and they've never recovered since they got rid of Mace, but they've suddenly had to build all these things, but you can't make it up.
Yeah.
It's really hard to make up lost time. And you look at the foresight. I look back at the old, and you remember this. I look back at the old Metro Conference. Like, where did that conference go when it was Louisville and Cincinnati and West Virginia and Virginia Tech? I think East Carolina was in that maybe, or it was the same level as this. Was it Southern Conference or whatever they used to be in? You know, Dowdy Ficklin Stadium looked exactly like Virginia Tech used to look.
Yeah.
You know, and all those teams cranked it up to try to get to a much higher level. And now everything's about how many people can you get to watch you on TV? You know, the ticket sales don't really, those are budget savers for other things.
Well, I want to mention Saban's interview was the congressional interview.
And, oh, I thought you were going to talk about my. I thought you were going to mention my interview with him where I didn't go.
No, I actually didn't know about that, but we could talk about that also. But when I heard his interview, I about jumped out of my chair because, you know, just so many things hit home with me when he was, you know, talking about a value-based system that he was always developing, the student part of the athlete, you know, the quality of life, basically talking about how the, you know, NFL coaches are even saying now that the guys are, you know, they're less developed, they have less resiliency to overcome adversity. There are more entitlements with these guys coming in now that have been, you know, going through this whole thing with the portal and NIL. And, you know, it just really hit home with me because I just remembered, you know, particularly down through the 90s, those guys and through Ruffin's era, too. But, you know, the things that I think about, you know, and probably you can probably relate to these two through the time that you were there. But and I'm talking about East Carolina. You know, I'm talking right. about that yeah. culture. I'm talking about that stadium, that fan base, the Pirate Nation that I grew to know. You know, and yeah. from 1991. You know, the leadership within the team, selling out for your teammates. Having a fanatical work ethic, the power of agreement that we had,
yeah,
that blue collar mentality that everybody related to, the common standard of commitment, yeah. Taking enormous pride in taking care of your job, doing your job, defensively mastering your trade, for instance, your alignment, assignment, and responsibility. You know, taking a really high level of pride in that, the knowledge of the opponent, the film study, the personal commitment there. And then, you know, just loving these guys like family. Man, I love these guys like family.
Yeah.
They have them come over to my house.
Oh, yeah.
Eat dinner at my house. I mean, I just appreciated the way they worked so hard in the summer, the real tough stuff we did with the 300s. And then, of course, the winter conditioning everybody used to do. You know, we used to end that when I was there with four sets of 25 up downs on the gym floor. And then I had a lifting group no more than about 20, 30 minutes after that. Guys are setting records in there after that. So, yeah. I mean, you know, so I'm just never going to forget that.
Right.
And that whole thing with the team, the fan base, you know, you can talk about tobacco farming, whatever you want to relate to. And I raised 3 acres of tobacco myself that I always want to mention because, you know, I can relate to that too. But tell me how you felt.
When I was here?
Yeah.
Yeah, we felt all those things. I mean, who when they grew up as a kid watching Disney on Sunday didn't want to be a pirate?
Yeah.
You know, who didn't? What kid didn't one time, you know, want to be Captain Hook or and read all the folklore stories about pirates and stuff? I thought it was cool. I dug it while I was here. I thought there was a mystique about that, and I embraced it. I embraced the mentality of Eastern North Carolina and the farming and the textile industry, the blue collar. It was a lot like we had in the rural areas of Cincinnati, you know, Midwest values, kitchen table values. There's a lot of similarities, you know, Nick and Eddie Crabtree, my dear friends are from Dunn, North Carolina, and I'm from Deer Park, Ohio. We always joke to each other that, you know, our Deer Park and Dunn mentality, you know, of toughness and doing little things the right way and family and team. Everything that you said was emphasized here. And there was a thing that we did that Coach Holt Sr., that Lou had done at Notre Dame called the Notre Dame Experience. And during camp, every night when you had your team meetings for a stretch, every assistant coach or administrator that was involved in football, they had a presentation that night, and it was on specific topics that were on a list. And a lot of it was about, you know, the history of the school, traditions of the school, traditions of the area. It was just an overall experience to help give you more of a knowledge of your team. I mean, I always looked at it like, how did you feel when you were on your first Little League team, which you represented the whole city?
Yeah.
You know, when you had the first time I had Deer Park on my t-shirt or my baseball jersey, man, I had great pride in that. And you always had the cliche, you play for the name on the front of the jersey, not the one on the back. And all those things that you mentioned, were the core values, and you have to have similar core values to be successful. You know, Coach Holtz came in to visit Skip and us one spring, and Skip came down and said, "Hey, coach is going to be here and tomorrow, and he'd like to spend some time with the defense." I said, "How long?" He said, "All afternoon." I was like, "Okay." So we prepared for that. We prepared a list of questions. We prepared, and one of the things I asked him, and it was after we had started having success and we had back-to-back winning seasons. It was before 08. So it was in the spring of 08. And I said, "How do you continue to do this with the same staff and a few changes and to keep going higher and higher?" And the first thing he said is, "You got to have the exact same core values among the guys in this room with the staff. And then those are portrayed out and lived and shown to the players. And then they take on those characteristics of those core values. Within that system is also, what is your surrounding? You know, what is the, you know, what are the people that graduate from here? What's the industry? What's around you? The people that pay from their salary to come watch you perform, what do they do? What excites them? You know, what type of player are you going to be? And, for them to cheer, and all those little things go into it, to the mindset of a winning team. And for me, a great defense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the things that I mentioned, you know, those were the things that the strength of those things that enabled us to knock people off that we weren't supposed to beat. You know what I'm saying? And those were the things that gave the guys the confidence, no matter who they were going to play. Everybody knew when you came into Ficklin Stadium, you're getting hit in the mouth. You might have more talent, but you're going to get hit in the mouth for four quarters. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
You know, we kept the stat that the teams that we played against, what they do the next week, you know, and when your opponents have a drastic losing record on the game after yours, you know, you know what they've gone through physically. And we kept track of that.
Interesting. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, what I want to
do. We tried to beat you twice.
Yeah. This is something that people don't talk a whole lot about. You know, the whirlwind world of college coaching. You know, the joy of victory, the agony of defeat. You know, when I did a podcast with Chuck Pagano, we talked about the 10 things that his daughter, Taylor, talked about that she learned from her father as the daughter of a coach. And it was amazing.
How bad.
But one of them, of course, was the hardship of moving from town to town, having to go into a new school. It's kind of like where the transition of coaching, where kind of like the insanity begins and ends for families, and you know, where, you know, a high level of success can initiate change, a high level of failure can initiate change, you know, either one can initiate change. And, you know, I think we all have some shared experiences there.
Right.
And we try to capture some level of stability with our family in the interim. I lived away from my family, basically, you know, because when Coach Bunning got fired, I didn't know if I had a job. I moved my family to Morehead City. Then I was retained by Butch. I didn't know if I was going to be retained because I had turned a job down previously with Butch. You know, that I had to live away from my family. I'm not so sure we talk about these things enough and find resolution for this because I think when you talk about mental health sometimes with teams, with players, I think you need to talk about the mental health of coaches as well. When we go through these things, because a lot of times we get caught up in outlets and vices and temptations, whatever. You know, if you would share a little bit of your story there and your experiences.
Yeah. I think for decades, and you know, I saw this, you know, I have a master's in education and counseling, and I bet I did more counseling in my career than I did coaching. You know, every day somebody's coming in your office and they got an emotional problem. Every day. And sometimes it's more than one. And for forever, you know, until not all that long ago, you know, the mental health of the kids in college, you know, where's the resources at to go to the student center and, you know, see somebody when you're thinking about killing yourself? I mean, you get that granular on it. I mean, that happens, and it happens every year. And the mental health and the depression and the anxiety level that are on our young people today is insanely higher because of cell phones and information and bullying and things that get posted and things that get talked about. You know, you live your life through the feelings you get looking at a cell phone, and that's, you know, you got to battle that. And the resources have increased in the mental health. And I'll tell you, one of the guys that was an OG and having great help for the student athletes was Saban. Nick started it at Michigan State.
Yeah.
And was very adamant about it. And I learned what he did, and because Jimbo did the same thing at Florida State with the way our kids were evaluated and met with people during the week. And, you know, we were doing Zooms and phone calls back before other people were doing it. And, you know, there's a lot of things that happen. One, with the ups and downs of regular people that have clinically are depressed, have anxiety, and then they're in this arena and they're masking it with a drug or alcohol. And then that affects the family. And then there's divorces and there's, you know, there's kids that end up struggling within the family. There's just a lot of things that can happen that I've seen. And I've dealt with myself. You know, I live a life of recovery now. I don't drink anymore. I got out of control and I had to stop. But the thing that helped me the most is when I finally got right spiritually and I filled a void that I had in my spiritual life, in my faith, in my higher power. Once I was able to rectify and heal that, and I was able to completely surrender myself to turning things over and getting the frick out of the way, and that changed my life. And it was there because I got help from somebody or someone or some group. And it means taking the help and getting the help. But also, when you're involved in a team, you know, and you're responsible for that team or that department, you need to make sure that the care is available for them to be safe. I've had kids that have told me they thought about killing themselves. We've had people OD and have drug problems and alcohol problems. I know guys, you know, in the business that have it. But there's a reason for it. You know, what is ailing your heart or is depressing you or stressing you that somebody can help fix? And if the help is there, it can be fixed. But as long as it takes to find it, or as long as it takes to develop it, it's also as long as it takes to fix it. Right. You know, it's not something where you just go to a couple counseling sessions or a 28-day program or something like that. It's a life journey after that, with a commitment just like you had to the sport. You have to have it towards yourself and committing yourself.
That's a great point, man. Great point.
You have to do this for you. I don't live a life of sobriety unless I do it for me first. I can't do it for my family. I couldn't do it for, say I had players, say I was coaching. I can't do it for other people or for this reason or for a job. I have to do it for me to keep myself alive. And if I don't do that, then all the things around me are going to fail.
Right.
But it comes from, you know, getting that void. I use that word because that was what I felt. And it wasn't about how many times I went to church. It wasn't about how many times I prayed, which I thought it was, and it's not. And what I adjusted to in my life is I have a daily conversation with God all day long. It may be a lot in the morning. It may be in the afternoon, maybe at night. It may be throughout the day. But that is what's changed for me. And coaching was what I was probably born and supposed to do. But now I think I have a more sense of what my calling is. And it is to stay and have opportunities to help others with this mental health crisis, this stressful environment, and these depressed youth of our America that are struggling right now. And Hopefully I can lead by example, and hopefully I can have conversations with people that'll help them.
Yeah, I've been in school to be a health and life coach, something I kind of took on for a hobby, for something to do. And it's been very rewarding for me. And I'm very motivated to write a book about how coaches should take better care of themselves. Yeah. And, I want to have interviews with coaches in there, some real life stories. Did a podcast recently with Cliff Godwin that was just awesome, along these same lines. So I really appreciate so much you sharing that.
Certainly.
And I'll be praying that we get a lot of listeners as well. I'd like to ask you, like, with kind of like your goals now, which in the school I'm in, we call these magnificent obsessions, the three things you'd like to accomplish in life moving forward. Can you think of something there moving forward, your magnificent obsessions?
Yeah, first is just to be a better, wholesome person and to be there for service to others. Yeah. Second is to be a great father, to continue to support my family, father, husband, all those things that go into the family dynamic.
Yeah.
And then also to continue to be a great listener, to be able to help more people. It's not going to be about necessarily how much I know, but it will be about how much I care and how much I can show people that I care and I want to help them.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that we learn about in this system I'm in, is being an active listener.
Yeah.
Because how many times has my wife said to me, "What did I just say?"
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Yeah. Listening takes no strain at all. It takes no effort. But awareness, it takes a little awareness.
And before we wrap it up, I just want to mention kind of an idea I had. I really thought, like, maybe when a coach moves into another area with the family, for instance, and this coach has four or five kids, whatever, they've got to leave their school, leave their town, leave their friends. I think it would be valuable to put together a family transition team. And I don't know if anybody has that.
No, not that I know of. They put it on the other coaches' wives or support staff within the university. I was a proponent of, I wanted to move my kids immediately as fast as I could, because I wanted them to make friends before summer hit.
Yeah.
I wanted to get in the classroom for a month or two and make some friends and then be happy and adjusted by the time the summer hit. And again, it's, you know how this job is, you hit the ground running and you breathe when you can, and you come up for air when you absolutely need it. But other than that, it's even more so today in my many visits on the phone. And I've gone around here recently to some places and visited, it's never been a bigger sprint and lack of oxygen ever. And it's 24/7, 365 even during a dead period. There's something you're doing.
Yeah, I just think with my own kids, I mean, I just think about the transition periods, how, you know, a team of professionals may have really helped. I mean, and I'm talking particularly the kids.
Right. Because, that's why I wanted to get them in school, to get them in a system where they were going to be surrounded by new friends and teachers and stuff like that.
Yeah, because Taylor Pagano said, you know, she mentioned how tough it was moving from town to town, school to school, whatever. But she did mention that it forced her to learn how to make friends, learn how to meet people, which was the positive. But, you know, I've seen a lot of tough situations with coaches, with particularly with the kids. So I'm just going to throw that out there, and I may continue to try and promote that because I think it would be of great value.
You know, they have enough support staff right now in organizations that certainly could be added duties onto some support staff people. Absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt. And of course, involve some people in the high schools, maybe involve some clergy, maybe involve some pastors and so forth, some youth pastors.
Yeah.
Where, you know, a kid can go to a church and all of a sudden, you know, be surrounded by people who want to be friends and support them. And I think it'd be great.
You know, my kids, when we moved from Florida to back to Indiana, when I took the Purdue job, you know, my daughter was about to become a senior in high school. And we were really, she did not want to move. And we were really, really concerned. We went to see the schools in Lafayette, and we went to Central Catholic High School. When we showed up for the kids to shadow, they had the principal, the assistant principal, some other teachers, some coaches. They had the kids they were going to shadow, and they had my kids' names. They had this sign in the lobby of the school that had it was a marquee, and they had my kids' names in there. And that moment, my kids walked in, changed everything. My daughter told us after that visit, we went to lunch thinking, oh God, what's she going to say? She goes, I'm ready to move. I'll come here.
Yeah. Awesome.
You know, but it was completely because of how she was treated.
Right.
And they embraced her. And that's what you, as much as you may need, well, you got to go here. You got to do this. If you're embraced, genuinely embraced, and people again show you how much they care, you got a chance of really being okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think when a head coach hires people in that first meeting, he needs to say, "Hey, let's talk about your kids first. Let's talk about how they're going to transition. Let's talk about how your family's going to be happy." Because if your kids aren't happy, you're going to be distracted. You're not going to be happy. But if you see your kids are happy, it's going to be that much more. It's going to be that much better for you because, you know, you're going to coach better.
That's so, right.
You know. That's my opinion anyway.
You're right.
For whatever it's worth. So, hey, man, I just want to thank you so much for being on. And
absolutely.
Hopefully we can get together a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't know how much you're around Greenville, but I know you're on Pirate Radio today, so I assume you're around a little bit.
Yeah. I'm going to be, if you look at the calendar of a month, I'm either here the whole month or fully three quarters of it.
Gotcha.
And if I'm not, I'm out seeing my family as much as I can, but also cranking up this new life and opportunity. And I'm really fortunate that Nick and Eddie Crabtree have given me an opportunity to set new goals and have things that we talked about, and I have a chance to do those and make them attainable because I'm on their team now, and it's a good team.
Well, congratulations on all this, you know, congratulations on all the success you had at East Carolina. I don't think people talk about that era enough. So I just want you to know how much I appreciate it. Just having been a coach there, you know, how you guys perpetuated the success and achieved new goals with, you know, of course, two conference championships.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always say, you know, when my time comes, make sure that 99 peach bowl rings on one of my fingers.
Exactly.
So
I'm still lobbying for the back-to-back championship banners to be up in the next to the peach bowl thing and in the lobby in there.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna keep wearing JJ out until it gets put up.
Well, you know, I came to every ECU home game last year. I'm still supporting the Pirates. I, of course, I hope they get into a little tougher schedule in the future. I'd like to see them, you know, schedule some more of those Power Five teams moving into the future. Love to see that. But at the same time, I'll be there again this year supporting the Pirates and hope they have a very successful season. So thanks so much for coming on. I'm going to go ahead and close now, and we'll see you sometime soon. Thanks a lot, okay. Greg.
Thank you, sir, very much. Thanks, Coach.
This is Coach Jeff Connors signing off. God bless, and we'll see you all next week. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Absolute Empowerment with Coach Jeff Connors on The Sports Objective. Join us every Monday night for a new edition of the show. Listen to the show pretty much everywhere podcasts are found. Be sure to follow us on social media at TheSportsOBJ on Twitter and TikTok, at TheSportsObjective on Instagram. Like and follow our Facebook page and subscribe to our YouTube channel. As always, we appreciate you listening to the show, and go Pirates!